You're listening to Green Mountain Medicine, an original podcast series by ACP Vermont for all things internal medicine. I'm Haley.
And I'm Katie.
And we're your hosts.
This series aims to unpack the complexity of medicine in a nuanced and evidence-based way. We invite you to relax, grab some coffee, maybe some tea, maybe you're just a water person, and engage with us as we discuss the topics that impact our fields and characterize our practice.
So today we have Dr. Michelle Shepherd, who is currently an attending physician in pediatrics at the University of Vermont Medical Center. We can start from the beginning, where she completed her BS in molecular genetics at the University of Vermont, and then went on to complete her PhD in cell and molecular biology. And if that wasn't enough, then completed her MD at UVM and continued on to do her pediatric residency at Dartmouth Hitchcock. So that's an amazing amount of accomplishments that we've seen. My first question for you is, what made you want to do MD, PhD?
Oh, that's a great question. So I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I had a really strong background in bench research from my undergrad degree, which I really loved. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to particularly focus in clinical research or translational research or bench research. So I took the opportunity to do a combined program so I can get a little more experience and really figure out where I wanted to go from there.
Wow, that's so impressive. Was the combined program through UVM? So you would do your PhD and then your MD, or was it more split up?
Yeah, it was an interesting program. It was only around for about a dozen years, and it was a combined program. So you could start medical school, and then after the original clerkship block, you would enter into your PhD research. And when that was complete, you would re-enter basically as a third year medical student and finish up from there. So it was an interesting 7.5 year experience, but it was great.
Yeah, that sounds really long, but also extremely rewarding, because you probably have all this background knowledge that is really beneficial for your career as a pediatrician. Speaking of which, how exactly throughout your medical school journey did you end up wanting to follow the path of being a pediatrician?
I'm not someone that takes a direct line to anywhere. So I actually was pretty certain that I was going to be an obstetrician. And I did all my research for my PhD with a practicing obstetrician. And then at the time we were partnered with Maine Medical Center. And so I went to Maine Medical Center to do my clerkship. And after about 3 weeks in my OBGYN clerkship, I realized I was obsessing over the baby and had very little interest in surgery. And I think that was like the turning point for me. And anyone that knew me probably was not surprised. I surprised myself. But once I made the decision, I was all in.
I guess it's really easy when you're studying something so in depth to fall in love with the research aspect of it and then realize, oh, it's a little different clinically and completely change your mind. That's really fascinating to hear.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's a beautiful thing to always have in mind, right? Like to be able to follow whatever path best suits you. So digging into your pediatric lens a little bit more, Katie and I were wondering if you have a favorite children's movie and if that movie kind of helps you explain anything to patients, if you use that movie as kind of a background to get on the level of your pediatric patients.
Well, that's an awesome question. I have a soft spot for The Lion King, but that's from growing up. So that's probably my favorite of all time. My current favorite, because I have two children, is actually Elemental. So we talk about that a lot. I would say, honestly, I keep up on most of the popular characters because it's a really good way to establish rapport with kids. Just like, oh, I love your Paw Patrol shoes, or oh, I love your Hello Kitty shirt. And so it's really just knowing a little bit enough about the characters to make people feel comfortable to start talking to you. I'm starting to get better about knowing what's popular with adolescents. That took a while, but I have a 10-year-old now, so he's starting to get me more in tune with what's going on. I don't think I use it very often to describe what's happening, although I have found that a lot of kids have seen Daniel Tiger or some of the other, especially the PBS Kids characters will go to the doctors. And so we'll talk about that. 10 years ago, it was all about the Doc McStuffins, but that's kind of fallen out. So I do use those characters as like a reminder that everybody goes to the doctor sometimes and that it shouldn't be a scary thing. But, my favorite movies are certainly ones that are either heart wrenchers or have a really good moral and or good songs. My kids and I really still watch Moana quite regularly.
Yeah, the Moana soundtrack just can't be beat. I remember many years ago, I was a camp counselor and I was met by a bunch of kids who loved Paw Patrol. And at the time, I had no idea what Paw Patrol was. And so I said, wow, I really need to study up. I didn't think as a camp counselor I would need to do, extracurricular work, but maybe I'll have to bring that back in my clerkships, kind of figuring out what's cool with the kids these days.
It's honestly so hard to keep up though. To be honest, I don't even remember what I used to watch or toys that I would play with. Kind of going along with the, fairy tale children's movie sort of thing. If you could have a superpower to make your job a little bit easier, what would it be and why?
I would love to have a superpower that just brought a sense of calm to everybody in the room, like a diffuser of just, feeling settled and feeling calmed. Because I find that it's not always the kids themselves that are experiencing a lot of stress about the visit, but the support people or the siblings. And it can be just this kind of crazy environment, and everybody's just a little stressed out and they feed upon each other. And there are times where I wish I had a little bit of stress diffuser as I go into certain appointments.
And are there any sort of ways that you go about making it a peaceful environment for the families, seeing that they're really stressed? Are there things that we could do as medical students going forward to make it a more calming environment?
Yeah, I find that not having a barrier between you and the people in the room is really important. So this is where, being mindful that some of the room setups have you have your back to someone, or if you're looking at your computer, you're not, making eye contact and you're not able to really interact. So I'll often engage kids, no matter what their age, in the visit, engage them in looking at their growth charts, engage them in, hey, let's take a look at this. Oh, what about let's look at your x-ray together. I find that when you engage everybody in the room, ask each person if they have questions. So I'll intentionally ask not just the parents, but even the child if they have questions for me today or anything that they're worried about today. I find that that just gets the elephant right out of the room. And then I also find, honestly, that you have to make room for just being quiet. And especially when the rooms are really, really chaotic and there's a lot happening, sometimes just modeling in the moment, just like taking it down a notch, maybe just leaving some space for some open air after a question's been asked. Really, that intentional pause is really, really helpful. Because if I go in and I become rushed and stressed with the family, everybody can really feed on that and get more rushed and stressed. So I usually try to like walk into each visit. It's a new visit. I'm obviously not looking at the time to see what time it is. I think it's just really important to be present in the moment.
That's great advice. Hopefully, Haley and I will be able to do some of that. Fingers crossed.
Absolutely. That's the goal. So, touching a little bit more on the intersection between pediatrics and public health, especially thinking kind of your research background, potentially, Dr. Shepherd, can you discuss any community outreach or educational initiatives that you've been involved in to promote pediatric health and wellness?
Yeah, I have two primary areas of passion. One is in working with families affected by substance use and taking care of infants that are affected by substance use and adolescent health. So I have two big broad areas. So in the area of neonatal exposures to substances, I've done a lot of work through a quality improvement project at the Vermont Child Health Improvement Program. It's called Improving Care for Opioid Exposed Newborns. And we do a lot of work with medical providers, community agencies, Department of Children and Families, the Vermont Department of Health, really around engaging people in best practices for parental care, for pregnancy care, for postpartum care, for the care of infants, and really looking at it as a family unit. Not just medical providers, like we need to engage medical providers, but we also need to engage our nurse home visitors and our child developmental specialists that are coming into the room and our care coordinators and everybody that has touch points with the families. So I've been working on that project since I got here in 2017. It's a big area of passion for me. And then in the adolescent zone, I used to also work on a quality improvement project with VCHIP on adolescent health, but I now have a grant award from the National Institute of Drug Abuse looking at prevention methods for substance use avoidance for young adolescents. So we're starting some work around involving peers as a way to make little modules for people to watch that are age appropriate, not patronizing, not judgmental, and just talking about the benefits of avoiding starting substance use. There are some good examples of that being very successful, but here in Vermont, it's been a while since there's been a big campaign to get more education to the youngest adolescents. And really just, I like to think of it as catching people while they're being good, right? So the more you can reinforce these like choices and behaviors as people are making all their own choices now, it really helps them to feel a lot of sense of pride and ownership in their health. And so I like to work on both ends of the spectrum.
That's awesome. And field of work that I think is much needed. I was kind of wondering what led you to your interest in working with patients with substance use disorder, those that might be affected by it.
So I took a pretty specific interest in this population when I was in residency and did my residency advocacy project. I had some really great mentors and there was a lot of really good work going on at Dartmouth. And so I took it with me when I went to my first outpatient job in a rural area of the state where I did work with a lot of families affected by substance use. And I got involved in the ICON project like in 2014. And when it was time for me to come back to UVM, that was really my passion, was to come here and really work more heavily on the project. So I have a personal history of substance use disorder. And so I also take a personal interest in making sure that people get the supports they need, especially during pregnancy and postpartum, which is a really hard time for everybody, but can be particularly hard for people with a history of mental health or substance use, you know, any diagnosis for that matter. So yeah, it's been, you know, an ongoing passion for me, both personally and professionally.
Thanks so much for sharing that. And I think very interesting tidbit and almost reassuring to hear that, you know, if you have a true passion for something, it sounds like many fields of medicine can kind of accommodate that. Personally, I've thought about going into addiction medicine, and I'm always wondering, well, are there other paths that can include addiction medicine, for example, but maybe I don't have to, specialize in that per se. So I think it's awesome to hear that you're doing such important work.
We were also wondering, because you work with pediatrics is so difficult because you're working with such a vast population in a sense of they change so rapidly, but specifically with working with newborns and their parents, what are your recommendations for people nursing babies who are struggling with breastfeeding? And how do you really go about that process of education?
Also a big area of passion for me. So honestly, I highly recommend that people, they really start looking at supports before the baby is born, because it can feel like a completely foreign environment. Like maybe you get a breast pump and you feel like you're reading a manual that's not even in English, or you're your primary language because it is so confusing what this piece of equipment does. People will often come in with preconceived notions or family-derived notions about breast and chest feeding or breast milk provision. People come in with a lot of experience in their personal lives, or they may have some trauma associated. And so I always think it's key to start that discussion early and to let people know, you know, there are very few contraindications to breastfeeding, but it's still a choice. So we always want to work with people to best support their plan. So I do prenatal visits, which I think is really great when people can meet their pediatric or family practitioner before the baby is born and understand what kind of supports they have. Like in our office, we have a couple of people that are certified lactation counselors. We keep a list that's updated with lactation consultants in the community, because what can often happen is people are discharged at 24 hours after the baby's born, and it's just the beginning of the journey, and you really need support in the home, right? So, or in the doctor's office, you need somebody that can do hands-on help, right? Because it just is not something that you can just intuitively know how to do. And babies don't know how to feed, and nobody knows how to manipulate and have 12 pillows and 7 hands and what you need to really get that baby to practice feeding. And so we do a lot of support in our office, but also I recommend people get as much community support as they can. And that can look like, you know, better beginnings programs if your insurance covers it. It can look like home health referrals, because there's a lot of the nurse home visitors that are lactation consultants as well. And they can come in and what do you have? What kind of equipment? How can we support you? What's your plan for returning to work? How does your workplace feel about breastfeeding and pumping? And are there adequate supports in place to really make it feel like it's something you have planned for rather than something that's just a big black box when the baby is born all of a sudden? And we talk about it a lot. Now, we see people 1 to 2 days after they're discharged from the hospital. And the main thing we're doing at that visit is checking in about feeding and sleeping. You know, how are you doing with feeding and sleeping? I talk a lot about maternal care and nutrition because those things have to happen as well. And then we just kind of do this at each one of our visits is really check in on how feeding is going. Is it meeting their goals? What questions do they have? And then plans for either return to work, or is there a plan for night feeding so your partner can help? What kind of things do you need? And then talking to people about, you know, there are other things that are going on, like if people need to start a new medication, if people are returning to use of alcohol or use of cannabis, or, you know, they had quit smoking and they returned to smoking. So how can we do that really good, like harm reduction, supportive, non-judgmental support for people? A lot of people are going to have to start a new medicine, whether it's iron or whether it's, you know, something for their thyroid, or they have a new perinatal mood disorder that comes up. And so supporting people through all of that is such an important part of the journey. And then I remind people at every visit they come in, if you make it to 4 weeks, you need a pat on the back. If you make it to, you know, 8 weeks, pat on the back. If you make it to 6 months, you get a gold medal. Because in the US, for a parent to make it 6 months of breastfeeding is like only about a third of people, even though it's recommended to a year. And so I think really just re-engaging people at every visit, answering questions, making sure they have the support they need. And I mean, I've advocated for better workplace environments. You know, sometimes we've had to advocate for, you know, hospital grade pump or working with people's insurance, and it can just be such a process. But I think if you have a support in place, it makes a big difference. And then the other thing is people, the thing you want to do most as a new parent is feed your baby. That's like the primal need. And if you don't feel like it's going well, you're anxious about it, like I offer more frequent weight checks. Come in, we'll check your baby's weight, like if that's helpful, or we can have home health come in and check your baby's weight just to help that positive association between feeding and your baby growing, because that makes a huge difference.
I love those points that you made. Is it more frequently done, would you say, now just because we have all this education and all this support? Or would you say, based off your own patient interactions, that it's been pretty constant where it fluctuates depending on the person?
I think it's increased like significantly from the 80s. I mean, but as far as like the last 10 years, despite all of the, recommendations from the World Health Organization, from the American Academy of Pediatrics, there just really still isn't the parental paid leave that we need to help really facilitate that. And, although some workplaces and some states do a much better job protecting the rights to breastfeed and provide breast milk, not all of them do. And it's really hard to see people who are really committed, really struggle with their workplace. But I would say I see a lot more people coming in interested in at least starting breastfeeding, more like, 75 to 80% just really interested in starting breastfeeding. And that's great. And I think what would be nice is to see the people that can make it to 6 months get better. But I think that's going to take some big shifts.
You made some wonderful points just about having that support. I didn't even realize that home health was an option for some people.
How do you advise parents on managing screen time and technology use for children? So we're wondering what your take is on this.
Definitely, each age is a little bit different. With younger kids, it's really supporting two things. One, limitation of screen times, and two, making sure that the screen time is appropriate content. So, with kids that are under the age of five, so under preschoolers, we're saying like an hour or less, and it should be high quality screen time that you're with a parent. That's not always feasible. So the other thing I do is make sure that I'm like supporting families in doing the best that they can and making sure that they are, again, supervising what's being watched and there's not unlimited access to things that may be harmful. For that school age group, it really becomes important that I talk to the kids about it. So we talk a lot about balancing physical activity and screen time, and that, screen time is kind of part of life. You're doing it at school, so then it becomes like this normative thing that's really like it baked into our society. And there is a point at which screen time can be very harmful, and it can impact your ability to fall asleep. And there are things on there that can be really detrimental to your health and your self-esteem. So I engage parents, but I also engage kids really young with, I know there's some benefits of screen time, like, feeling connected and being able to, if you're 10 and you're gaming with your friends and that's your source of connection, great, but also like still limiting it and making sure your parents are keeping an eye on it. As kids get older, especially in that 11 to 14 group, we talk a lot about safety, especially if you have any access to social media, but also safety in online gaming or any platform where people may be asking personal information. So not only are we talking about, I really recommend that you limit it to, less than 2 hours if you can, looking for it to not be anything that's really causing you a lot of undue stress. So again, like, I've had people come in and say, I do 6 hours of TikTok. And then we talk about, well, what kind of content are you looking at? And why do you think it's taking up so much of your time? What's good about it? What's maybe not so good about it? Does it get in the way of homework? So kind of engaging people in understanding their screen use. I also talk to parents about modeling good behaviors, and that's true no matter what, right? So if you want your kids to eat healthier food, you eat healthier food in front of them, right? If you want kids to do less screen time, it really doesn't work well if you're on your phone the entire waking hours of your day. So really just thinking about modeling that. And engaging in conversation is the other thing. So talking about what are you doing online? Talk to me more about Roblox. Talk to me more about who you're following on TikTok and making sure that there's good parental limits and that they're doing some, putting some appropriate restrictions in place and in monitoring things and having that conversation again, that if you're talking to someone you know in real life, that's a lot different than a friend of a friend of a friend who may not be who they say they are. And then there is a recent research study out showing a significant decline in mental health with the increased number of hours of screen time. And so what I'll say is, this is something we suspected for a long time. And there are certain people that are more susceptible to feeling bad about themselves or feeling less happy in their lives as they spend more times on screens. And I just want to make sure you know that so that you can use that when you make your decisions. There is a formal tool that I've had some families use called the Family Media Use Plan, and that's available freely on the American Academy of Pediatrics website. So for parents that are really struggling with setting boundaries, that can be a nice way. It's interactive. They can come up with a family, how each one of them, including the parents, are going to use screens. So that's another option. But I definitely talk to people about, I know it's part of your everyday life. I know zero screens doesn't make sense, but how much is it impacting your life? And are you finding a good balance?
That's great advice. So many great points. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I think, even though I'm sure it's like very overwhelming as a pediatrician, what the most important questions are to ask of your patients, or maybe what the most important educational tips you share with them are, I definitely agree. I think advising, like especially that preteen age, and having a conversation about safe internet use is really, really important.
Switching gears a little bit, when you have parents who have multiple children, how do you handle situations where the parents may express concerns about developmental comparisons between siblings? And how do you reassure and guide them through these discussions if their development is a bit different?
I find that a lot, especially in households that have multiple age children. So generally, I do talk to them about that there really is something to be said about the difference in parenting between your first child and subsequent children and the interaction of children because they have older siblings. So it's a very different environment to grow up in the first year all by yourself, or to be like the fourth child that has all these older siblings to watch. And so I do talk to parents a lot, and we do a lot of formal developmental screening, but also informal developmental surveillance, that what we're looking for at a milestone is roughly what about 75% of kids can do. And so there's going to be kids on each side of that. So, a lot of times people will come in and be like, hey, he's 12 months and he's not walking. My first child walked at 9 months. What's going on? And you're like, wow, that was a really early walker. And there's a really big range of normal. So anything between 9 and 15 months is normal. That's why the average is 12 months. And so I'll talk to them a lot about, well, they're showing us all the signs that they are on track with their gross motor. And I'll always be like, and do you feel like there's another area that they might be a little ahead in? And a lot of times, oh, yes. Well, they have so much more language than their sibling did. And so we can just be like, hey, everybody is following their own developmental trajectory that is shaped by their environment. So if there's other children, it's going to be different. If they go to daycare, it's going to be different than if they stay home, right? But what we're looking for is signs or patterns of areas of developmental delay. So certainly we would never downplay a parental concern. And I always tell them that. I'm like, if you have a developmental concern, we can refer for early intervention, Children's Integrated Services, to have a full developmental eval because you are worried, right? Now, if I'm worried, I'm going to bring it up and be like, yes, we need to do this. But if a family's worried, they can also self-refer. And that can be really helpful as well to have someone come to you, see the child in their environment, and really help reassure families. But I do often just be like, there is no one normal, right? Everything is on a like wide variety of bell-shaped curve. Most people have seen that curve before, right? So I can, in most cases, talk about, there's always going to be that kid that got their first tooth at 3.5 months, right? And there's going to be the kid that gets their first tooth at 13 months. And, all of those things, just like development, happen along a spectrum. And I promise they'll all get their teeth. Right? And that really helps. And people will be like, oh, yes, I had a kid that got teeth really early and a kid that got teeth really late. But, at two, they all had all their teeth, right?
No, that it makes me laugh when you're talking about that, the firstborn and the secondborn. And I think about how my sister is the firstborn and I was the secondborn. And I actually had the opposite, where like usually the second's really social because you have your older sibling to talk to, but it ended up being my sister was just doing everything for me. So I would just point to something. And then they sent me to a speech pathologist and they were like, she's not talking. We're so concerned. And then when I was alone with the speech pathologist, they were like, no, she's talking. She's fine. It's just her older sister's doing everything for her. So it's funny to think about, oh yeah, the second is usually the social and language development, and the first is, all the motor skills and everything like that. So it's just interesting.
That's so funny. I didn't know that, Katie. I mean, like, and look at you now. You would never know, right? Yeah.
Yeah, now I never shut up now. So that's the maybe my sister needs to stay around a little longer.
That's so funny. See, for me, it was like very interesting. So I'm an only child. So I actually didn't walk until 15 months, which is like on the later side. And I always just liked, my mom calls it staying sedentary. I would just like literally recline, always reclining. I wouldn't sit up. And I was doing some reflecting on that recently, and I feel like not much has changed, but that's just a personal preference and a lifestyle, you know? And here I am, I'm doing okay, I think.
Yeah. You absorb everything in your environment, take it all in, synthesize.
Exactly. I'm just chilling, reclining. Dr. Shepherd, we're kind of wondering in your practice how you go about discussing gender identity with families, especially since we learned in school that kids are usually aware of their gender identity by around age 4. So this is something that I'm assuming kind of starts pretty early in your practice. And what resources do you have to refer to parents, or children for them to use?
That's a great question. So I find, thankfully, over the last few years, it has gotten better. I think there's more parental awareness. Now, that doesn't always equal parental acceptance, but I do think that there's been more parental awareness about the development of gender identity. With that being said, I often will just ask kids flat out, no matter what their age is, like, what do you like to be called? You know, and that's really helpful because a lot of times kids have nicknames or they have, you know, other names that they prefer for themselves that they could, you know, sometimes it's very silly. Like that day they want to be called a unicorn and I'm okay with that, right? You just roll with it and you just respect. I think the thing I have always found to be helpful is to respect boundaries and choices in the office. So now we do talk a lot about, you know, feelings about, you know, what is a good touch, what is a safe touch, what is your private parts, what do you call them, who would you talk to at school if something happened. So I feel like we talk a lot about making sure that people feel comfortable either ideally both at home and at school or whatever other environment they're in, feeling accepted, and if they're finding that they're having difficulties. So one of the questions I like to ask, particularly since kids spend so much time at school, is I always ask them, like, first, tell me one thing you like about school. And then I'll always say, tell me one thing that is hard about school, you don't like about school. And then we'll go into the conversation that, hey, if you're having trouble with math, if you're having trouble hearing in the classroom, or if you're having trouble with people being mean to you, who are you going to let know? Because we can't help if we don't know about it. And that has opened that conversation up quite a bit. For parents, there's actually some really wonderful resources out there. I often start with healthychildren.org because I feel really confident with the AAP's materials in supporting families, and they're not politicized in a way that I feel is detrimental to the families. As just one resource. As kids start to get a little older, they've also put out a really nice book called Youology, which is a puberty book for everybody. And I love it. And you can start it like probably, some kids at 8 already. It might be more like 9 for some other kids, but it talks about the earliest things that happen with your body and what it means to, if you don't feel comfortable with your body, if you feel like, you know, you might be transgender or you're gender fluid, or but what it means and what body things are going to happen just based on, you know, hey, you have this genetic makeup, so these things might happen to your body, and these are people you can talk about it. We're very fortunate to have the transgender youth program here as well, and I have a really good relationship with that program. So we can get kids in to talk with, you know, the social worker is a really great place to start because they'll see where families are at. Like, do you guys need, you know, connection with counselors that actually can, you know, have some expertise or sensitivity for kids that are experiencing any sort of, you know, because some kids are not in distress about their gender identity and some kids are. And so being able to identify which kids and families need support now and which kids and families are already rolling with it really well is important because sometimes they don't need to see the physician, right? They're not talking about hormone treatments, they're not talking about puberty blockers yet. But they can get started with the program to say, what kind of supports do you need? What should you be thinking about as you come down the line? What about things like, you know, pronoun changes and making sure the school's on board? How can we help support that? And so I think really just being there as part of a medical home model, and knowing that we can help with advocacy at school or advocacy for receiving appropriate services, whether again that's a school counselor or a clinical psychologist or someone in the community, it's about connecting families.
I was reading a piece on, I think it was the Vermont Digger recently, about how some families have actually started moving to Vermont from out of state because of the health care that they can get for their children who have various gender identities or maybe are transgender that right now isn't offered in other states. So I think that's really nice to hear kind of more in depth what that might look like. I also had a question for you, and this might be a little bit of a silly question. So Katie and I learned in school that for some older children, when you start talking about topics like sex or drugs, it's best to go about those conversations privately with your patient who's a child or a teen. And I'm wondering, in patients who might be a little bit younger, but maybe you sense that there might be something going on with their gender identity, and maybe they don't feel very comfortable discussing it, do you ever consider chatting with the patient independently?
Often it depends on the child and the family. So sometimes it would completely ruin the therapeutic relationship. And sometimes it's easy to ask parents to step out. And so usually I would say I start the talk about, at your next visit, we're going to have some time to chat, just you and me, at about 10, because at 11, I usually begin that chat. And, for some families, it's helpful to be like, this is part of the exam where we might have to examine your privates and we need to talk about private topics. And so it's best for you to have a little privacy during that time. And, your parent can just step outside the door if that's best. They can go to the waiting room or we can start the appointment by ourselves. I think introducing that early on is really important. And certainly, there have been other situations where sometimes it's really helpful if I have someone else in clinic with me and we can have one person talk with the family and one person talk, like I can talk to the child. And that can be like one of my care managers or social workers. I've definitely had students and residents where I'm like, hey, can you chat with the family about any sort of concerns they may have? And, just give me a few minutes to chat with the child. And generally, I find that that's well received if you have a good relationship. What you don't want to do is jeopardize your relationship with the parents, because at that point, they would stop bringing the child in for care and you can't be that advocate or a support person. And, again, it's very similar to when I have people come in to talk about mood. I'll talk to them alone, I'll talk to them with a parent present, and sometimes I'll even talk to the parent for a few minutes to get their perspective. But I let people know how important that is, really, that we can talk freely and especially about sensitive topics, And I certainly have had parents that will not leave, right? And that's unfortunately, you remember those visits. Thankfully, they're few and far between, but they do stick with you because it tends to be rather uncomfortable. But I would find that, again, if we have a good relationship with the family, they feel really comfortable. And honestly, even before the time that I start meeting with kids alone, I will start introducing the idea to the parent. And we'll talk about, like, and this is so funny, I often embarrass parents more than the child, because we'll talk about with a 10 or 11-year-old, I'll start talking about, so have you noticed other kids are vaping at school? And the parents are like, oh my gosh. And I'm like, and then the kids will be like, oh, absolutely. The bathroom is full of it. They put, monitors on the outside of the bathrooms, and parents won't really know about that and won't have any understanding that their kids are being exposed to these topics, whether in person, online, like through friends. And so I think it's just as long as you have a nice, trusting relationship and parents know what I'm going to talk about. I'm like, there are things we're going to talk about. And I think it's best that we talk one-on-one. It's less embarrassing for everyone, And again, I find that if you have a good working relationship with the families, that it usually goes very well.
That's great to hear, and also great advice, especially as Katie and I are moving to transition to starting clerkships very soon. So it's good for us to learn what's best in these situations.
Speaking a little bit more about care for adolescents. So during our, I think it was a month ago now, where we took the class of human development and reproductive health, which I believe you taught one of those classes. And one of the classes we had the sort of advocacy for patients with developmental disabilities, such as CP.
And I was just wondering, this seemed to be a major concern within that community of just how to approach the transition of care for adolescents with these chronic medical conditions into the adult healthcare setting, and how pediatricians seem to kind of hold on to these patients a little bit longer just because it's really hard to find someone who can continue that care. So how would you go about that? Or is there any changes that you would love to share with us that are you were thinking about?
So I'm fortunate we have some nurse care coordinators in our office that often are working with families with complex medical needs, and they help coordinate between different specialists, between insurance issues, between the medical home and school. We definitely start talking with families early because often kids with disabilities will have an extension of high school, so they get more time, and so they can continue to receive supports there. It's when that ages out that can often be an area where people kind of fall under the radar. We do kind of keep in our back pocket recommendations for providers that take special interest in kids with special health needs because it has to be something that you take interest in. And a lot of our family medicine providers have been so great about it, but you can't transition every kid right away at 18. A lot of times we are holding on to kids to 22, 24. Sometimes a little longer. And it really just depends on when they transition their specialty services. And I know the Children's Specialty Center here has been doing really great work around that transition, almost like a warm handoff to the adult specialist, because what you don't want to happen is they stop seeing the pediatric specialist and then it's years before they can get to the adult specialist. You really want that warm handoff to happen, especially with like neurology, gastroenterology, things like that. So I lean pretty heavily on my care management team to really help with that, make sure guardianship has been taken care of, make sure that we're doing our best to make sure that, people are connected with, different resources for disability, for SSI, for housing, we don't have everything we need. We're very lucky in Vermont that we have really invested, providers. We definitely don't have everything we need. What we really need is more assisted living situations. And we have to work heavily with the designated agencies as they do a lot of the work with young adults and older adults with disabilities, and that can be really frustrating. So, there's only so many services available and there's so many people that need to be served. So I would very much love if there was a straight path. We do try to keep people in network whenever we can, if that's feasible, right? So if you're living in the same vicinity, at least your medical records will be there. So you don't have to redo the story every time. But it can be really hard, especially if people are receiving specialty care at other hospitals, like Children's Hospital in Boston, to then coordinate to that move to adult specialty care can be hard. But definitely, it's definitely a work in progress. It's an ongoing area that we're really looking for more resources to support families because, again, we have been involved with care management, on weekly basis is texting and emailing and stuff with families. And then the adult care management pathway is very different. So I would love if we had like the mirror image of our pediatric care managers going into adult medicine instead of that really adult, like diabetes, heart disease focused, which is important, but really focused on those specific conditions coming into and trying to take over these children that had pretty complex medical issues.
Sure. I'm sure it's pretty bittersweet for you because I'm sure you want to hold on to these patients in a sense of keeping them safe and comfortable, and you've had so many years with them that you know them so well. And then now it's kind of the handoff and the track meet, and you're just hoping that the other person goes as fast as you. You know what I mean? So that's definitely a challenge. And thank you for sharing and highlighting some of the key gaps in it.
And our last question for today is just about whatever advice you might have. I thought it was really interesting earlier how you mentioned how you really don't have a straight path to anything. And I love that. I think it's great. So what's your advice for people out there who maybe are interested in pediatrics or interested in medicine, but might not have a straight path?
I generally say go with your gut. There are going to be many times where things are going to be fluid and things are going to be uncertain. And there's going to be a few times where you just know and don't question that and don't let anyone else question that. I would have loved to be one of those people that knew when I was five what I wanted to do and went straight through, and that's not my path, but I think I had a more like well-rounded and interesting path because of that too. I've met and been, lots of people in my life have changed careers or done a second residency, or so also just the reminder that, it's not, you're not pigeonholed into one thing. And there are so many different opportunities. I've known people that went to fellowship like 20 years into practice. And, there's always going to be that opportunity to continue your education. And one of the things I'm very passionate about, though, is I like to continue to keep myself refreshed. I don't like to sit back and just be like, oh, yeah, I'm an attending now. I know what I'm doing. I really like to continue to like, ooh, this is an interesting new grant. Let's look at this. Ooh, this is, and maybe that's just me, but I find that that helps keep the burnout at bay when you're really taking little tidbits of things that you're passionate about and bringing it into your practice. And I'd also say, like, I've changed what my job looks like multiple times. Like, I was in primary care out in a rural area where I did newborn care. I had to come in at 2 a.m. I admitted patients. I did EEs. And it was crazy and I loved it, but it was crazy and I was ready to come back. And then when I came here, I was doing like 70% research and I was like missing my clinical work. So I got more clinical work. And then for 3 years, I worked in the nursery in addition to everything else. And then I pulled back out of that. So I think it's just also knowing that we are so fortunate when we complete medical training that the opportunities are just all out there, and you can do so many different things with a medical degree. And you can decide at some point you want to retire and do consulting, which wouldn't work for me, but works for lots of people. You can work for CDC or, work for an insurance company. So I just think it's so important to listen to your gut. Like, I knew in one moment in one surgery C-section, oh, yes, it was like a clear moment of clarity. Oh, I need to go into pediatrics. And then I was absolutely certain I was going to be a neonatologist. And then I had a parting thing happen to me in primary care where I'm like, oh, no, this is it. No, I'm a primary care person. And I didn't let people tell me that I couldn't do research in primary care, right? I didn't let people tell me that I couldn't do advocacy. Like, you can do all of those things. And I didn't let people tell me I couldn't have a family. I have a family too, right? And it's important that you have the other things in your life that are really meaningful to you as well.
I love that. I think that's so inspiring. And, you mentioned burnout, which obviously is ever present in our field. But I think with your advice, hopefully Katie and I can avoid that as much as possible. And we're so glad that you came on the podcast today. Thank you so much for being here.
All right, folks, if you're still here, thanks for sticking with us. That's it for today on Green Mountain Medicine. I'm Haley.
And I'm Katie.
And thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed our discussion, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at ACP_Vermont for more podcast updates, or subscribe to us on YouTube at Green Mountain Medicine.